It's time.
We are not called to be nice.
Sandy Rios. Welcome, Sandy. Thanks for being here.
We are often called to be confrontational.
And here with me in D.C. is Fox News contributor Sandy Rios.
And you still like me, or you don't like me, James?
Are you okay? You're all right.
I'm a musician. I can't help it.
Longtime Fox News contributor Sandy Rios, thanks very much for being with us.
We have, I think it's 4-1 youth in America wants gay marriage.
Our kids are the product of public schools. No wonder they poll the way they do.
It's time to stand up or we're going to lose everything we have.
Director of Governmental Affairs for the American Family Association.
Step up, speak up, say something, do something.
This isn't a game. This is real life.
Sandy Rios is with the American Family Association.
A pro-life radio talk show host.
Some things are worth fighting for.
Welcome back to Act Two of today's circus, ladies and gentlemen. We are here to continue what the Democrats tell us is a serious, somber, and even prayerful process of attempting to overthrow a duly elected president. If they're successful, the end result would be to disenfranchise tens of millions of Americans who thought the president is chosen by the American people, not by 13 Democrat partisans on a committee that's supposed to be overseeing the government's intelligence agencies. And isn't it strange how we've morphed into the impeachment committee, presiding over a matter that has no intelligence component whatsoever? Impeachment, of course, is the jurisdiction of the Judiciary Committee, not the Intelligence Committee. But putting this farce in our court provides two main advantages for the Democrats. It made it easier for them to shroud their depositions in secrecy, and it allowed them to avoid giving too big of a role in this spectacle to another Democrat committee chairman, in whom the Democrat leaders obviously have no confidence. Who can possibly view these proceedings as fair and impartial? They are being conducted by Democrats who spent 3 years saturating the airwaves with dire warnings that President Trump is a Russian agent. And these outlandish attacks continue to this very day. Just this weekend, in front of a crowd of Democratic Party activists, the chairman of this committee denounced President Trump as a profound threat to our democracy and vowed that we will send that charlatan in the White House back to the golden throne he came from. How can anyone believe that people who would utter such dramatic absurdities are conducting a fair impeachment process and are only trying to discover the truth? It's obvious the Democrats are trying to topple the president solely because they despise him, because they've promised since Election Day to impeach him, and because they're afraid he will win re-election next year.
That was Ranking Member Devin Nunes from California, the ranking member in the Intelligence Committee behind Adam Schiff, who is the ranking member. And, of course, Devin Nunes is referring to what Adam Schiff said just a few days ago. We played that for you over the weekend. He talked about the president being a charlatan and they were going to send him back to his golden throne, and was an incredibly derogatory and also inappropriate statement for someone who's supposed to be overseeing a hearing that's supposed to be trying to actually honestly figure out if the president is guilty of high crimes and misdemeanors to be impeached. All right, so that's how Devin Nunes, at least that's the first part of his opening comments yesterday. I realize the hearings went on for hours, hours and hours. I can't imagine that there are any of you who listen to all of it. How could you possibly, or even any of it? I find it tedious. It's very hard for me to listen to. And we also have lives, you know? We have work to do. We have things we have to accomplish. And meanwhile, the Congress slugs away at this. And so I'm going to give you as much of an overview as I can in a few minutes here today. And then I have a lot of other news I want to bring to you. But I want to, this is important. I'm telling you, in spite of the absurdity of it, it is still very dangerous. They have the power, the Democrats have the power to impeach this president. They likely will, and it will likely go to the Senate. And Mitch McConnell has said, we must, by necessity, we have to hold a trial. And so it will go to the Senate, and we cannot be assured of what's going to happen there. I know people say there are enough votes. I mean, they can't get two-thirds in the Senate to impeach the president, but tons of damage can be done. And meanwhile, can you imagine for even just a second how many things in this country need to be handled? Can we say border? Can we say immigration? Can we say the budget, funding the military? Can we say all of the things that are not the Mexico-Canada trade agreement? Can we say all of the things that are just completely neglected because our congressmen in Washington, the Democrats who lead the House and establish, you know, what's discussed there, they have all control, are bent on impeaching the president. So that's what all they're doing. That's all they're doing. So, all right. So this was a very interesting exchange yesterday. Lieutenant Colonel Alexander Vindman. And by the way, do we have that short clip, you guys, where Vindman corrects Nunes? I didn't see it on here. I bet we do, where he talks about his title. I don't see it there. Okay. It's part of five. All right. So we'll get to that in a second. Vindman is a witness who actually listened to the phone call and had given secret testimony. He came in his uniform. We talked about him at great length last week. And so he was called up now to publicly testify. And Devin Nunes is cross-examining him. And I just want you to listen to how this goes. Clip four.
Lieutenant Colonel Vindman, did you discuss the July 25th phone call with anyone outside the White House on July 25th or the 26th? And if so, with whom?
Yes, I did. My core function is to coordinate U.S. government policy, interagency policy, and I spoke to two individuals with regards to providing some sort of readout of the call.
Two individuals that were not in the White House?
Not in the White House, cleared U.S. government officials with appropriate need to know.
And what agencies were these officials with?
Department of State, Department of State Deputy Assistant Secretary George Kent, who is responsible for the portfolio Eastern Europe, including Ukraine, and a individual from the office of an individual in the intelligence community.
As you know, the intelligence community has 17 different agencies. What agency was this individual from?
If I could interject here, we don't want to use these proceedings.
It's our time,
I know,
Mr. Chair.
But we need to protect the whistleblower.
Please stop.
I want to make sure that there's no effort to out the whistleblower through the use of these proceedings. If the witness has a good faith belief that this may reveal the identity of the whistleblower, that is not the purpose that we are here for, and I want to advise the witness accordingly.
All right, so Adam Schiff just wants to protect the whistleblower. I mean, we have to protect him. But here, just listen to the absurdity of this. Back away for a second. So Nunes, Vindman is there to testify. He's there to ask questions and answer them under oath. He's not there to say, I can't talk about that. He's to honestly answer all of the questions that the committee members ask him, and he is under oath in doing that because the truth is trying to establish the truth here. So Vindman says when he has this unnamed person that he talked to about the phone call, he won't say what agency, he won't say who it is. Then he also says, and you're going to hear this in a second, he doesn't know who the whistleblower is. He has no idea who the whistleblower is, has just no idea. And Adam Schiff has already told us that he has no idea either. He does not know who the whistleblower is. And yet when Devin Nunes is interacting with Vindman and asking him, who is that other person? Who is the person? What intelligence agency? Who are you talking about? Adam Schiff jumps in and says, we have to protect the whistleblower. How does Adam Schiff know? So let's let this continue. So Nunes, again, interacting with Vindman. Let's listen.
Mr. Vindman, you testified in your deposition that you did not know the whistleblower.
Ranking member, it's Lieutenant Colonel Vindman, please.
Lieutenant Colonel Vindman, you testified in the deposition that you did not know who the whistleblower was or is.
I do not know who the whistleblower is. That is.
Well, how is it possible for you to name these people and then out the whistleblower?
Per the advice of my counsel, I've been advised not to answer specific questions about members of the intelligence community.
Are you aware that this is the intelligence committee that's conducting an impeachment hearing?
Of course I am.
Wouldn't the appropriate place for you to come to testify would be the intelligence committee about someone within the intelligence community?
Ranking Member, per the advice of my counsel and the instructions from the chairman, I've been advised not to provide any specifics on who I've spoken to with inside the intelligence community. What I can offer is that these were properly cleared individuals, or was a properly cleared individual with a need to know.
Well, this is, you can plead the fifth, but you're here to answer questions, and you're here under subpoena. So you can either answer the question or you can plead the fifth.
On behalf of my client, we are following the rule of the committee, the rule of the chair with regard to this issue. And this does not call for an answer that is invoking the fifth or any theoretical issue like that. We're following the ruling of the chair.
What, Counselor, what ruling is that?
If I could interject, counsel is correct. Whistleblower has the right, statutory right to anonymity. These proceedings will not be used to out the whistleblower.
And I've advised my client accordingly, and he's going to follow the ruling of the chair. If there's a alternative or you want to work something out with the chair, that's up to you, Mr. Nunes.
Well, we've attempted to subpoena the whistleblower to sit for a deposition. The chair has tabled that motion and then has been unwilling to recognize those motions over the last few days of this impeachment inquisition process.
Yeah, so basically, here we go. The Vindman, I don't know the whistleblower. I don't know his identity. Adam Schiff, I don't know the whistleblower. I don't know his identity. I have no idea. So Vindman is asked, who is the other person you told about this phone call? And Adam Schiff jumps in and says, oh, we have the whistleblower deserves protection. So how does he know it's the whistleblower? And how does Vindman know? He doesn't know, he said, who the whistleblower is. It is absurd, absolutely absurd. Jordan points this out later in an exchange. This is clip 10.
You know, as I indicated before, this committee will not be used to out the whistleblower.
I don't see how this is outing the whistleblower. The witness has testified in his deposition that he doesn't know who the whistleblower is. You have said, even though no one believes you, you have said you don't know who the whistleblower is.
Yeah, so that was Jim Jordan. I want to jump right here. Jackie Speier had an interesting interaction with Vindman later. I think the answer did not turn out the way she thought. This is clip 6.
Some of President Trump's allies have suggested that the president requested these investigations for official policy reasons as part of some plan to root out corruption in Ukraine. In your experience, did the official policies of the United States include asking Ukraine to specifically open investigations into the Bidens and interference by Ukraine in the 2016 election?
Nothing that we prepared or had discussed up until that point included any of these elements.
Would it ever be U.S. policy, in your experience, to ask a foreign leader to open a political investigation?
There are proper procedures in which to do that. Certainly the president is well within his right to do that. It is not something the NSC, certainly a director at the NSC, would do. As a matter of fact, we are prohibited from being involved in any transaction between Department of Justice.
Okay, well, I'm interrupting, but basically the president could do it, and you should have seen the look on her face. All right, so that was Vindman affirming that the president has every right to do what they're alleging that he's doing. I would say the thing that really stands out to me is I've spoken to you so often about CrowdStrike. That's the first thing the president mentions, and that's what he's very clear to ask the president of Ukraine to look into. Could you please look into CrowdStrike? That is that Ukrainian-controlled company that went into the DNC server at the request of the Democratic National Committee to investigate who hacked their email. Who did that? It was that Ukrainian-controlled server who said, oh, it was the Russians. And it was that was the foundation for Mueller's report, for all of the nonsense we've been hearing for the last 2.5 years. And they're not talking about that. I don't understand even why the Republicans are not mentioning that. They're concentrating and defending on the whole notion that the accusation that the president is asking for Ukraine to investigate his political opponent. I'll have more to say about that in a second. I'm not going to spend the whole day on this, but we'll come back with a few more clips after this. Sandy Rios in the morning, AFR Talk.
So when people first hear about MediShare, they have questions, some really good questions, starting with the obvious, what is it?
Well, MediShare is a Christian healthcare sharing ministry. It's not health insurance. It's a different way of doing things, which leads us to the next question. Why do people do this? Why do they become MediShare members? Here are two of the biggest reasons. Number one, people feel good about it. They're not trapped in a plan that makes them pay for things they don't believe in. They know their money is going to help people. And the second reason, people save a lot of money. Maybe you've heard us mention the typical family saves about $500 a month switching to MediShare. And one more big question, does it work? The answer is yes, 1,000 times yes, or 400,000 times, since that's how many MediShare members there are, and they've shared over $2 billion in medical expenses. So easy to find out right now how MediShare can work for you. Call 833-44-BIBLE. That's 833-44-BIBLE, 833-44-BIBLE.
This is Pause to Pray, a chance each day to stop down from the daily noise of life and pray for our country's leaders.
Today we pray for Vicki Christensen, Chief of the U.S. Forest Service. She leads a workforce of more than 25,000 employees who oversee 193 million acres of national forests and grasslands. Genesis 2:15 reminds us of the importance of caring for our lands. The Lord God took the man and put him in the Garden of Eden to work it and take care of it. Right now, with this in mind, let's pray together. Dear Heavenly Father, we ask for guidance for Vicki Christensen in her work with the Forest Service. We ask this in Jesus' name, amen.
Pause to Pray is a service of this station and the Presidential Prayer Team. This Christmas season, send a prayer or Christmas greeting to President Trump and his family. Your message will be delivered straight to the Oval Office. It's fun, easy, and it's free. Learn how at pausetopray.org.
Hello, Americans. I'm Todd Starnes with news and commentary next.
For me, Truett means opportunities.
Truett means an adventure.
Place where I can grow and become more like Jesus.
This is somewhere I belong.
To me, Truett is like a home far away from home.
Everyone is family from all different walks of life and from all over the world.
To me, Truett means a second home.
Truett McConnell University is home for me.
Hi, this is Todd Starnes, and now you know why I love Truett McConnell University. If you think you're having a rough day, wait until you hear about Jawad Bazar. Mr. Bazar owns a business in the Five Points neighborhood of Denver, a nice place to run a business until the Democrats took charge of things. Mr. Bazar says that his area has been overrun by homeless people and drug addicts, tells the local television station his alleyway has become a de facto bathroom stall. So you can imagine his anger the other day when he received a citation from the city of Denver. According to the Department of Health, Mr. Bazar is responsible for cleaning up all that human waste and disposing of all those dirty needles. That's right, folks. Instead of punishing the people pooping in the streets, the city of Denver decided to punish the law-abiding business owners. Be sure to check out my all-new Toddcast podcast. It's a free subscription at toddstarnes.com.
Don't forget to connect with Sandy Rios in the morning on Facebook or email Sandy at sandy@afr.net. That's sandy@afr.net. Sandy Rios in the morning on American Family Radio.
The day began with decorated Army officer Lieutenant Colonel Alex Vindman, who testified that the July 25th call at the center of the entire impeachment hearing was inappropriate and improper. He was joined by Jennifer Williams, an aide to Vice President Pence, and fireworks flew when Vindman was asked who he was talking about with about that call. Listen.
What agency was this individual from?
If I could interject here. We don't want to use these proceedings.
It's our time,
I know,
Mr. Chair.
But we need to protect the whistleblower. If you testified in the deposition that you did not know who the whistleblower was or is.
I do not know who the whistleblower is.
And when it came to Speaker Pelosi's fundamental allegation that a crime was committed, Republicans dug in.
You've never used the word bribery or bribe to explain President Trump's conduct, correct?
No, sir.
Colonel Vindman, you haven't either.
That is correct.
In the afternoon, key testimony came from Special Envoy Kurt Volker, the point man leading Ukrainian policy for the U.S., and NSC staffer Tim Morrison, again, Republicans zeroing in on policy.
Did the President of the United States ever say to you
that he was not going to allow aid for the United States to go to the Ukraine unless there were investigations into Burisma, the Bidens, or the 2016 elections.
No, he did not.
At the end of the day, though, the man leading it all, Chairman Adam Schiff, just blasted Republicans for defending President Trump. Listen.
Their objection is he got caught. Their objection is that someone blew the whistle. Their defense is, well, he ended up releasing the aid. Yes, after he got caught.
Now, as you mentioned, Brian, Ambassador Gordon Sondland is up next at 9 a.m. All eyes on him. He's truly the wild card because Republicans and Democrats both want to talk to him because he spoke most indirectly with President Trump. We don't know how it's going to go in the afternoon. Mm-hmm. Two more witnesses, Pentagon official Laura Cooper, along with Undersecretary of State for Public Affairs, David Hale.
All right. So that's Griff giving us the rundown this morning on Fox and Friends about what's going to be happening today. One thing, a couple of observations about this. One theme that comes across repeatedly and did last week also was that these various witnesses for the Democrats for impeachment, at least they view them as their witnesses, the theme for them consistently, including the fired ambassador, was their concern for Ukraine. They express it over and over again. One of their concerns was that with President Trump being elected, the Ukrainians, according to a very long and detailed political expose, did everything they could to stop President Trump from being elected. Much of that so-called collusion was happening with Ukraine and the Democrats. It was spelled out in Politico. We talked about that article several times, and I guess we should put it back on our Facebook again so you could see it, because it was written, I think, in 2017. It's just a very extensive, all-encompassing article about the corruption and cooperation between the Democrats and Ukraine. All right, so these various people were serving during that time under Obama, and many of them were participating in trying to stop President Trump because they wanted the other policies to be advanced. If President Trump came in and this new Zelensky was elected president, which he was, then they were concerned, they said, they've even admitted this, that they were concerned that aid would be harmed to Ukraine because the views and the people that had been working in Ukraine prior to the election would be punished and aid would be withheld and Ukraine would be hurt. So the old pervading concern by Vindman, by the ambassador, by all of them when they testify is, poor Ukraine. Ukraine must have this aid. Now, look, I'm overstating this. I'm not saying, I am not indicating by my sarcasm that Ukraine shouldn't have the aid. But I'm trying to overstate to give you, to just try to make a point here. Their overwhelming concern was that Ukraine get money from the United States. They act as though Ukraine deserves it. And any consideration by a duly elected president of withdrawing it or removing it is just unheard of. They can't. Ukrainians have a right to your money, your tax dollars. And because they want to push a certain agenda. They want to help Ukraine do whatever it is they want Ukraine to help. But not really any concern about the America, not any concern about the European Union not helping with Ukraine, which is one of the President Trump's big concerns about this, which is one of the reasons he withheld aid just for a short time. He thought that especially Germany should step up to the plate. They're in the vicinity. They have a lot to lose if Russia gets out of control. But no discussion of that. And certainly no discussion of CrowdStrike and the corruption and cooperation between Ukraine and the Democrats in the 2016 election. I don't understand why the Republicans are not bringing that up. I don't understand that. I really don't. Unless these investigations that are going on with the Justice Department are going to expose that. Maybe that's the reason they're laying low on that. That might be the reason. But anyway, of course, I could go into a lot more detail about what's going to happen today, but you get the gist of it. There'll be more testimony. And we certainly know that Gordon Sondland is the key witness this morning, and he's an ally of President Trump's, and everyone's looking at him to see if he's going to, you know, turn against his acquaintance or someone that he supported financially, which is Donald Trump. We'll see. All right, so new polls are showing that the impeachment hearings are having minimal impact on public sentiment. I know that, I believe last week, the tally was that only 13 million Americans were listening, and that was a tally of every network, every outlet that was covering it, which is very small. And Fox News was leading the pack of those that were people were listening to, but 13 million Americans was not very much. And now I believe the report is showing that there were less people watching yesterday. Here's a poll released on Tuesday, and it is a poll by Politico Morning Consult. It's found that during the first week of hearings, 47% of respondents support the House impeaching President Donald Trump, compared to 44% who oppose. But now the numbers are shifting, and I got to get this right. When asked about the Senate removing Trump, support increased slightly to 48%, but that number was 2% points lower than support expressed for removal in a Political Morning Consult poll conducted a week earlier. Bottom line, there's 2 points less support for impeachment, and there were, I think, as I recall, 3 points increase on those that did not want to see impeachment. So, and then here's the thing, you know, as I've said about these polls, these are not coming from conservative outlets. We don't know who they're polling. They did say of the people they polled, 58% said they were closely or somewhat following media coverage of the impeachment inquiry. Well, that's got to be a very select group of people, because I don't think there are 58% of I don't think hardly any Americans are watching this. Some, they're tuning in some, but I would be very surprised. In fact, they say a third of their respondents said they have not watched the public hearings at all. And so I think that's probably pretty accurate tally. I'm sure I don't doubt that particular number. Anyway, so that's how the impeachment proceedings are proceeding, and they will be starting this morning. I want to change the subject because there's something really important that happened just over the weekend. It was the end of last week, and I want you to hear it. I did play a clip from it, a short one on Monday, but I'm going to repeat it. And here's basically the setting. Attorney General William Barr was asked to speak at the Federalist Society. This was Friday night, to be specific. It was for the annual Barbara Olson Lecture. Barbara Olson was the pundit married to the Solicitor General at the time when she went down on 9/11 in one of those planes. And we have her final words to her husband. And Barbara was, actually, I knew Barbara. I'm not stating she was my best friend, but I knew her. I used to interact with her a lot. And she was a very dear friend of a lot of my friends, a real champion and a real hero as she went down in that plane. It's just so sad. So that was the annual Barbara Olson Lecture. All right, so the Attorney General Barr made an incredible speech. And I can't give you the whole speech, but I am going to read quite a lengthy portion of it. We will play this clip because I want to give you just a taste of it. Here's Attorney General Bob Barr on Friday night for the Federalist Society. Let's listen. Clip 16.
Unfortunately, just in the past few years, we have seen these conflicts take on an entirely new character. Immediately after President Trump won election, opponents inaugurated what they called the resistance, and they rallied around an explicit strategy of using every tool and maneuver to sabotage the functioning of the executive branch and his administration. The fact of the matter is that in waging a scorched earth, no-holds-barred war of resistance against this administration, it is the left that is engaged in the systematic shredding of norms and undermining the rule of law.
All right, so that was amazing, and that was a little composite. That was Attorney General William Barr, not Bob Barr. I keep saying that because, let me say again, Bob Barr was someone I used to interview a lot during the first impeachment, so forgive me that constant slip, but William Barr is the Attorney General. Now, let me go back to what he actually said. And I want to read part of this transcript. Please, I hope that I can make it as clear as possible. This is also a truncated version. But I want you to hear what your Attorney General said. This is pretty amazing stuff. I want to repeat. Immediately after President Trump won election, opponents inaugurated what they called the resistance. and they rallied around an explicit strategy of using every tool and maneuver available to sabotage the functioning of his administration. Now, resistance is the language used to describe insurgency against rule imposed by an occupying military power. It obviously connotes that the government is not legitimate. This is very dangerous, indeed incendiary, notion to import into the politics of a democratic republic. What it means is that instead of viewing themselves as the loyal opposition, as opposing parties have done in the past, they essentially see themselves as engaged in a war to cripple, by any means necessary, a duly elected government. A prime example of this is the Senate's unprecedented abuse of the advice and consent process. The Senate is free to exercise that power to reject unqualified nominees. Now, he's talking about judicial now. Excuse me. But that power was never intended to allow the Senate to systematically oppose and draw out the approval process for every appointee so as to prevent the president from building a functional government. And he's not just talking about, my allergies. All right, so he's not just talking about judicial nominees. He's talking about nominees to head departments. They have held up all of those nominees. That's why the president has so many acting heads of various departments. Okay, but I digress. That is precisely what the Senate minority has done from his very first days in office. As of September of this year, the Senate had been forced to invoke cloture on 236 Trump nominees. Each of those representing its own massive consumption of legislative time meant only to delay an inevitable confirmation. How many times was cloture invoked on nominees during President Obama's first term? 17 times. The second President Bush's first term? 4 times. It is reasonable to wonder whether a future president will actually be able to form a functioning administration if his or her party does not hold the Senate. And then he turns to Congress. Congress has in recent years also largely abdicated its core function of legislating on the most pressing issues facing the national government. They either decline to legislate on major questions or, if they do, punt the most difficult and critical issues by making broad delegations to a modern administrative state that they increasingly seek to insulate from presidential control. And then he gives examples of what he means. This phenomenon first arose in the wake of the Great Depression, as Congress created a number of so-called independent agencies and housed them, at least nominally, in the executive branch. More recently, the Dodd-Frank Act's creation of the Consumer Financial Protection Branch, a single-headed, independent agency that functions like a junior varsity president for economic regulation, is just one of many examples, basically saying the Congress has abdicated their responsibility to oversee the various things that they need to decide for this country. And they create these agencies and then abdicate control to them. And that's a breakdown. It's certainly not what the Founding Fathers intended. Those are my words. Back to General Barr. Of course, Congress's effective withdrawal from the business of legislating leaves it with a lot of time for other pursuits. And the pursuit of choice, particularly for the opposition party, has been to drown the executive branch with oversight demands for testimony and documents. I do not deny that Congress has some implied authority to conduct oversight as an incident to its legislative power. But the sheer volume of what we see today, the pursuit of scores of parallel investigations through an avalanche of subpoenas, is plainly designed to incapacitate the executive branch and, indeed, is touted as such. When we return, I'm going to continue with this because I just think it's worth this. I am gaining, I'm growing leaps and bounds in my respect for this Attorney General. His insights and his willingness to call out what he sees is requiring incredible courage. He will be anathema in D.C. He already is. They're coming after him to impeach him, too. They're talking about it. I guess they're kind of busy right now. But I want to continue with what he said at the Federalist Society because really, really, it affects all of us. Sandy Rios in the morning on AFR Talk.
The only thing necessary for the triumph of evil is for good men to do nothing. My name is Abraham Hamilton III, and this is the Hamilton Minute. What is the proper role of government? Romans chapter 13 outlines government's function, and it is basically this: to restrain or to punish wickedness and to reward righteousness. Government was never intended to be our savior. Government is our servant. As we focus on our civil occupations and our civic engagement responsibilities, let us never forget that government is not our God. We don't put our trust in it. We put our trust in our Christ. As a result, what we want is a government that stays out of our way and leaves room for our church to do our business of fulfilling the Great Commission.
Listen each weekday from 5 to 6 p.m. Central for the Hamilton Corner with Abraham Hamilton III, public policy analyst for the American Family Association.
Merry Christmas. Merry Christmas.
Hey, I love that you're saying Merry Christmas. But what's Christmas all about?
Oh, man, it's about presents and family and love and...
Well, yeah, but it's really about Jesus. He came for you. Merry Christmas.
Thanks, man.
Wear and share the AFA Christmas button to remind people about Jesus. He came for you. Visit afastore.net to order in packs of 10. Order before December 12th to make sure you get your buttons before Christmas. That's afastore.net.
The AFA Journal highlights the extraordinary work of Operation Heal Our Patriots, a ministry of Samaritan's Purse. Here's Franklin Graham.
These men and women who are wounded serving our nation, they need our support, they need our prayers, their marriages need help. Samaritan's Purse is committed to walk with them and help them.
Look for Matthew White's article, Help for Hurting Heroes, in the November edition of the AFA Journal. Visit afajournal.org.
Brian Fisher here with today's Life and Liberty Minute. Chick-fil-A declared this week that it will no longer support any Christian charity, including the Salvation Army, that believes in a biblical view of marriage. They are doing this under relentless pressure from the homosexual lobby, which since 2012 has hammered CFA over its support for pro-family organizations. This is a huge victory for the homosexual lobby, which got the third largest restaurant chain in America to meekly submit to its demands to reject the Bible. Chick-fil-A's donation to the Salvation Army was used to provide Christmas gifts for the children of inmates. Next year, these kids will be on their own. CFA's motive seems to be a craven devotion to its bottom line. Jesus said we must choose to serve either God or mammon. This week, Chick-fil-A made its choice about which master it will serve.
Catch Brian Fisher on Focal Point, weekday afternoons at 105 Central on American Family Radio.
This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. House Democrats' hopes for their amazing shrinking impeachment inquiry now rest on U.S. Ambassador to the European Union Gordon Sondland. That's because the previous supposed star witness, Lieutenant Colonel Alexander Vindman, amounts to a partisan Trump opponent in uniform. Worse yet, for Vindman's supporters, the record now reflects serious concerns expressed by superiors at the National Security Council about his judgment, conduct, and discipline with respect to the chain of command. Among other things, he's believed to have been a leaker of sensitive information. The government of Ukraine thought so highly of Lieutenant Colonel Vindman, however, that it invited him to become its Minister of Defense on three different occasions. That alone would seem to disqualify him from serving as the National Security Council official responsible for the Ukraine portfolio, let alone being an impartial witness against the president. This is Frank Gaffney.
Sandy Rios in the morning on American Family Radio.
Sandy Rios back with you. On the lighter note, Thanksgiving is just around the corner. You know that, right? But then that means Christmas is just around the corner. So there are some things that we are getting ahead of with Christmas. I kind of actually don't like it that Christmas is drowning out Thanksgiving. I think they're both important. I think pausing to thank God for his blessings is so important and changes our heart and minds and gets us ready, actually, to celebrate the birth of Jesus. But we have to get ahead of things here because of the nature of what we're talking about. We have our Christmas buttons available to you. They say, Jesus, he came for you. They're beautiful, and they're available at afastore.net, afastore.net. They come in packs of 10. And so, needless to say, you need to order them now so that you can have them to wear in the month of December. Also, we are working with Samaritan's Purse as we always do with Operation Christmas Child, which means that you need to get your shoebox from your church or some outlet. And if you don't know what that is, go to SamaritansPurse.org/OCC. That's Operation Christmas Child, SamaritansPurse.org/OCC, to find out where an outlet is near you. Most of your churches are participating in this, I'm guessing. So it shouldn't be hard to find. You need to get your shoebox, pack it with these wonderful gifts. They'll give you some guidelines for the kids in these third world countries. And then it needs to be turned in by November 25th. So this is the collection week, and we just want to remind you of that gentle prod, shall I say. All right. I've been talking to you about the speech that William Barr made at the Federalist Society on Friday night. William Barr, of course, is the Attorney General of the United States, and his insights are amazing, and his straightforwardness. But I want to get into more of his words and talk less here. He talks about how the Senate has been resisting through not allowing president's nominees to go through. Then he's talked about how the Congress, both houses, have abdicated their role and created these agencies so that they don't have to make the tough decisions. And then he said they've, in the absence of actually governing, they've then started this what they call oversight, demanding for testimonies and documents. And he said I'll go on with his words. He says the costs of this constant harassment are real. For example, we all understand that confidential communications and a private internal deliberative process are essential for all of our branches of government to properly function. Congress and the judiciary know this well, as both have taken great pains to shield their own internal communication from public inspection. There is no FOIA. That means the legal process to get their inside deliberations. There is no FOIA for Congress or the courts. Yet Congress has happily created a regime that allows the public to seek whatever documents it wants from the executive branch at the same time that individual congressional committees spend their days trying to publicize the executive's internal decisional process. That process cannot function properly if it's public, nor is it productive to have our government devoting enormous resources to squabbling about what becomes public and when, rather than doing the work of the people. In recent years, we have seen substantial encroachment by Congress in the area of executive privilege. The executive branch and the Supreme Court have long recognized that the need for confidentiality in executive branch decision-making necessarily means that some communications must remain off-limits to Congress and the public. There was a time when Congress respected this important principle, but today Congress is increasingly quick to dismiss good-faith attempts to protect executive branch equities, labeling such efforts obstruction of Congress and holding cabinet secretaries in contempt. One of the ironies of today is that those who oppose this president constantly accuse this administration of, quote unquote, shredding constitutional norms and waging a war on the rule of law. When I ask my friends on the other side, what exactly are you referring to? I get vacuous stares, followed by sputtering about the travel ban or some such thing. While the president has certainly thrown out the traditional Beltway playbook, he was upfront about that beforehand, and the people voted for him. What I'm talking about today are fundamental constitutional precepts. The fact is that this administration's policy initiatives and proposed rules, including the travel ban, have transgressed neither constitutional nor traditional norms and have been amply supported by the law and patiently litigated through the court system to vindication. Indeed, measures undertaken by this administration seem a bit tame when compared to some of the unprecedented steps taken by the Obama administration's aggressive exercise of executive power, such as, under its DACA program, refusing to enforce broad swaths of immigration law. The fact of the matter is that in waging a scorched earth, no-holds-barred war of resistance against this administration, it is the left that has engaged in the systematic shredding of norms and the undermining of the rule of law. This highlights a basic disadvantage that conservatives have always had in contesting political issues of the day. It was adverted by the old curmudgeonly Federalist Fisher Ames in an essay during the early years of the Republic. In any age, the so-called progressives treat politics as their religion. Their holy mission is to use the coercive power of the state to remake man and society in their own image. according to an abstract ideal of perfection. Whatever means they use are therefore justified because, by definition, they are virtuous people pursuing a deific end, deific meaning godlike. They are willing to use any means necessary to gain momentary advantage in achieving their end, regardless of collateral consequences and the systematic implications. They never ask whether the actions they take could be justified as a general rule of conduct, equally applicable to all sides. Conservatives, on the other hand, do not seek an earthly paradise. We are interested in preserving over the long run the proper balance of freedom and order necessary for healthy development of natural civil society and individual human flourishing. This means that we naturally test the propriety and wisdom of action under a rule of law standard. The essence of this standard is to ask what the overall impact on society over the long run, if the action we are taking or principle we are applying in a given circumstance was universalized. That is, would it be good for society over the long haul if this was done in all like circumstances? For these reasons, conservatives tend to have more scruple over their political tactics and rarely feel that the ends justify the means. And this is as it should be, but there is no getting around the fact that this puts conservatives at a disadvantage when facing progressives wholly far, especially when doing so under the weight of a hyper-partisan media. That's the first part of his speech. This is, again, the words of William Barr at the Federalist Society on Friday night. He then next takes on the judicial branch, which I don't have time to read, but it's equally powerful. And in summary, he warns that in the passion of our times, we risk causing permanent disfigurement to the genius of our constitutional structure. And then he defends and ends by defending the need for an energetic presidency. This is amazing. I mean, this is amazing. I have to tell you what went through my mind when I'm reading this. This is very premature, but I've heard discussions lately. I've heard it said, if President Trump wins this next election, who would follow him? Who could possibly follow him? Who could possibly continue this battle in Washington? Who is there? What other champion? And I have to say, I don't think it's Mike Pence, but I think it might be William Barr. He has articulated, he understands the problems. He's got courage. He's already shown us what courage he has. I just think this is stunning. We'll put it on our Facebook page and you can read the entire thing. And I recommend that you do and pass it to your friends because we need to know if there are champions in Washington. Heaven knows we need to hear about them, don't we? And remember that he has empowered John Durham to investigate the corruption in the FBI and other agencies, and we're getting ready for that report. I don't know when, but it's going to be amazing when the thing drops. And that ties into my next story. You may remember that, speaking of champions in Washington, Louis Gohmert is one of them. This was an interaction that Louis Gohmert had when Peter Strzok was sitting, the FBI agent who was dismissed, who was having an affair with the attorney at Justice and was leading, we know, very intricately involved in this resistance and trying to stop President Trump. We know all about their texts back and forth. So Louis Gohmert was interrogating Peter Strzok, and this is how it sounded way back when.
And let me tell you, when you have text messages, Mr. Strzok, the way you do, saying the things you did, you'd been better off coming in here and say, look, that was my bias. And you kind of get around to that a little bit when you say, hey, you know, everybody's got political views. Those are called biases, and we all have them. And you have come in here and said, I have no bias. And you do it with a straight face. And I watched you in the private testimony you gave. And I told some of the other guys, he is really good. He's lying. He knows. We know he's lying. And he could probably pass a polygraph.
Point.
It's amazing.
Mr. Chairman.
No, this is my
Mr.
time.
Chairman, I'm sorry.
It needs
point
to be
of order.
Paused.
This point of order.
No.
The general state is point of order.
A member of this committee just asserted that this witness, who is under oath and a former agent of the FBI, lied. There is no evidence of that. I ask him to withdraw it.
I do not withdraw it. He is not a member of Congress. It's not a violation of the rule. And just as you have been expressing bias through your members about what a hero...
There is not a single person on this committee who has ever characterized a witness...
Gentleman from Rhode Island. Gentleman,
it's my time.
That's a disgrace.
Gentleman from Rhode Island will suspend.
No, the disgrace what this man has done...
The gentleman from Texas will suspend for a moment.
There is the disgrace. And it won't be recaptured anytime soon because of the damage you've done to the justice system. And I've talked to FBI agents around the country. You've embarrassed them. You've embarrassed yourself. And I can't help but wonder, when I see you looking there with a little smirk, how many times did you look so innocent into your wife's eye and lie to her about Lisa?
Mr. Chairman, it's outrageous.
The credibility of a witness
Mr. Chairman, this is intolerable harassment
of the witness.
What's wrong with that? You need your medication.
All right, so that was Louis Gohmert. That was a pretty incredible interaction. And, of course, Louis was giving us a heads up about something that he knew that the rest of us now know because it's being made public, that the Department of Justice just released documents on Monday outlining a whole bunch of security violations and flagrantly unprofessional conduct by ex-FBI agent Peter Strzok. And then they detail how his wife found out about his affair with Lisa Page on an unsecured exchange between them. And the point is that Peter Strzok was the chief guy on intelligence, and he is using unsecured devices to talk about the president, to talk about FBI investigations, and they know that because his wife was able to access these texts. And so that's kind of the nut of that. And by the, let me read Fox News' accounting of this. The Department of Justice released documents Monday outlining a slew of security violations, flagrantly unprofessional conduct by anti-Trump ex-FBI agent Peter Strzok, including his alleged practice of keeping sensitive FBI documents on his unsecured personal electronic devices, even as his wife gained access to his cell phone and discovered evidence that he was having an affair with former FBI attorney Lisa Page. All right, now, let me read further, because do you guys remember, in the midst of all of that, do you recall that there was a group of policemen or FBI agents and or both in the New York office leading up to the 2016 election? They've discovered Anthony Weiner's laptop contained all of Hillary Clinton's secured email. Remember that story? And remember that laptop was never turned over. The FBI never investigated that. And you may recall that we talked about how these guys were threatening to quit. They were going to revolt in the FBI, and the policemen were up in arms because no one was looking into this. And so now we have some insight. It says the DOJ was seeking to dismiss Strzok's lawsuit, claiming he was unfairly fired and deserves to be reinstated as chief of the counter-espionage division of the FBI. In its filing, the DOJ included an August 2018 letter to Strzok from the DOJ's Office of Professional Responsibility, OPR, which found in part that Strzok had engaged in a dereliction of supervisory responsibility by failing to investigate the potentially classified Hillary Clinton emails that turned up on an unsecured laptop belonging to Anthony Weiner as the 2016 election approached. The situation became so dire, OPR said, that the case agent in New York told federal prosecutors there that he was scared and paranoid that somebody was not acting appropriately and that somebody was trying to bury this. Remember that story? Well, it did make its way up to the disciplinary agency that's oversees the FBI misconduct. So now we're finding out about it. And this is part of what's probably going to come out in the Inspector General's report. But just wanted to give you insight. There are people really in Washington fighting. They're fighting. So pray for them and pray that God will allow the truth to come out and justice to prevail and wash over this nation. Sandy Rios in the morning on AFR Talk.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast may not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.
Faith, family, freedom. American Family Radio.